when Abu Sufyan visited him, or he was called by him, I think that's the way the story goes, that the emperor actually called Abu Sufyan to his court. And because he had heard that there was a prophet in Arabia, which astounded Christendom at that time, they wanted to know more. And, you know, who did they, you know, speak to about this issue? The greatest enemy of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. But anyway, the emperor was very astute. He was very clever in terms of how he paraphrased his questions to him. And he said to him, he says, what is the quality of this man, this Prophet Muhammad? And he says, what kind of people follow him? Who follows him in Arabia? And he says, the poor and the slaves. And that's where you took me when you mentioned that exact point, that this is one of the qualities of the awliya. This is one of the qualities of the holy prophets, that they carry the common man. And this is very, very important, because we spoke in contrast about the fact that how the elites don't trust the people and hate the people. And this is why they're becoming police states, aren't they? I mean, this is why the U.S. is going to use drones now on their own population. So this is the sort of thing. But to carry on with our discussion, please take it to the next level, because we are really talking about, you know, we talked about the opinion of the expert opinion of Rahbar. We talked about the supreme leader. But I think you're now going to quote some other experts now on their view of this great personality.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I promised to quote two things from the Supreme Leader last program, only got to one of them.
Oh, did you? Right, okay.
So the one thing that I quoted was from a speech that was, you know, in the past.
That's right, yes.
Right. And he basically talked about how, you know, Imam was really somebody on the level of, you know, or close to the level of the prophets and the awliya in terms impact on the world.
Sure.
And the second thing I wanted to quote, again, from the Supreme Leader, talking about how Imam was and, you know, the beauty of just seeing that person and the way they lived and the example that they were, and the fact that he combined this deep piety and complete submission, as you were speaking about in the previous program, to God, being a complete, you know, servant of God, and at the same time leading humans and leading societies and confronting, you know, the most powerful of the oppressors and of the zalimeen, as is
the famous quote that was given in most UK papers. They translated it from the Farsi, Butt Chicken. Thank you very much for that. But the idol smasher of our time. And you saw a picture
of
the Statue of Liberty and
very
communism being broken up and stuff like that.
It's very interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, I'm going to get to this idea of Butch Chicken later, because that's also a very important thing for many people. That was, you know. But the quote that the Supreme Leader, this is the one from the Supreme Leader talking about Imam, the one that he recently made, which is a combination of Imam being both a deeply pious and spiritual person in his personal life.
Sure.
And also, at the same time, being a leader of peoples, which is something that, in the Western view, in the modern view, is, you know, separate. You are either a monk in your, you know, separate in your desert, you know, retreat, or
sure,
you are,
hermit,
you know.
Yeah.
Whereas Imam completely broke that.
Sure.
He was, just as he was spiritual, he was also a leader of humanity, which is what Islam tells us. This is what the Prophet did.
Sure.
This is what
Imam
did.
We are going to listen to that quote now.
کسی مثل امام بزرگوار ما
Somebody like our magnanimous Imam, who single-handedly entered the arena, managed to unite all the people and launch this great movement with his firm determination, faith, and reliance on God, relied more than anything else on knowledge and understanding, on worship of God, and on the enthusiasm which originates from one's heart and soul. Until the end of his life, this great person used to wake up in the middle of the night and shed tears despite being old and physically weak.
با وجود پیری و ناتوانی و شکستگی نیمه شب بر می‌خواست اشک می‌ریخت. ما خبر داشتیم از نزدیکان ایشان که به
We knew it because we had heard from his close relatives, who knew everything about his lifestyle, that he used to wake up in the middle of the night and ask Allah, the Exalted, for help. He used to keep a vigil at night. He was like this at night, and during the day, he used to enter the arena like a roaring lion and defeat global powers and solve the people's problems. He used to strengthen and set in motion the determination of all the people thanks to his reliance on spirituality.
همه ما مردم رو تقویت می‌کرد و راه می‌انداخت به برکت اون پشتوانه معنوی.
Very, very powerful words there from the Supreme Leader about this great personality of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul. Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I mean, what can we say after that? I mean, the thing is that he certainly, you know, put it in a nutshell, you know, that this is a man truly of God. And he enters the arena in order to guide mankind against the most powerful demonic forces that were there at the time.
Right, and I mean, this is the thing that we were talking about, which is that, you know, this was completely, had been lost in humanity.
It
the
had
fact
been,
that
yeah.
you could be somebody who was deeply spiritual.
Deeply spiritual, yes.
And, you know, devoted in your personal life and in your worship, you know, on a daily basis, in the middle of the night, you know, wherever it was that you had to be connected to God, and at the same time be somebody who is, you know, completely active and leads a nation towards its liberation and towards
independence,
know, its
yes.
independence, its awakening. Mm. It's and, you know, these are things that, you know, over the years, when you look at how Western civilization developed, how,
sure.
you know, religion was put aside, how you had this idea of, you know,
that materialism was the way to go.
Right. And mm. again, this has to do also with Christianity itself.
That's
the
true.
Fact that it failed in many, many ways.
Of course it is.
In order to really satisfy the needs of humanity. And this is why we say that Islam is the deen al-haq, is the religion of truth.
Truth, yes.
Is the one that's the most updated version for humanity.
Exactly.
The one that actually, you know, is able to satisfy all the needs of humanity. This is why we're Muslim. Because
exactly.
we say Islam is a complete religion.
Mm.
And again, I want to emphasize these things. These things, we've talked about this before, but it's always good to remind
yeah,
ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of these
I mean, I think
you
it's
know,
worth
there's
mentioning
no point in, mm. in having a God that doesn't care about people. There's no point in having a God that doesn't care about social justice. There's no point in having a God that doesn't care about the liberation and the liberty of human beings. There's no point in having a God that allies himself with the oppressors.
No.
Okay?
No.
So I'm saying these things in a strong way because we have this very...
And I thank you for it.
Mm. Odd image of, like, you know...
Mm. But that was the image that was given, being
right.
given to
I
us.
I mean, the idea that, you know, God, you know, he's the one that's... he's the main thing.
Mm.
You know, he's not going to forget about the people who are poor and deprived. And, you know, like you mentioned very nicely, the fact that you always had the prophets... You know, and of course, at the best example of it being Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, being, you know, with the poor and the slaves. And we have the same thing with, you know, Prophet Ibrahim. We have the same thing with Prophet Musa.
Absolutely.
You know,
Moses,
with Prophet
yes.
Isa, peace
yes.
be upon them all.
Sure.
You know, you look at, and it's even in the Bible. It's in the Torah.
Yes,
you know,
is,
these are not things
is.
That, you know, but also in our, you know, in the Quranic version of their stories, you know, the people that follow them are not the elites initially.
No.
Because they are a threat to the, you know, money, wealth, and power, and of these elites. The fact
well,
that these
I mean
elites
I
would
I
be
I
above the law.
If I could make a quote from the media, which I heard recently, and it's a quite a funny quote, facetious quote, but it's interesting. We believe in the prophets as the 124,000 that came into this world as Muslims, but the elites believe in these prophets, which is just...
You know, with F.
With F.
As opposed to PH.
PH, exactly.
Exactly. So this is the point, you mm-hmm. know. And like the Supreme Leader was mentioning, here is a man, you know, even in old age, mm-hmm. even at a time when he was physically...
Yes, as the Supreme Leader was
you know,
saying.
When he was physically,
very powerful,
you know, ill and, you know, mm-hmm. getting up in the middle of the night, besieging...
Beseeching, yes, that's the word, yes.
You know,
yes.
Beseeching at night and besieging the enemies at, in the
yes, besiege, because he did mention that.
And creating the besiege.
Yeah. And he created the besiege, yes. The volunteer
so,
defense
so,
force.
So, you know,
right.
these are the things that, this is why people followed him. This is
of
why
course they
this
did.
Is why we always look at him and think of him as the most important person spiritually that we were able to, you know,
I think
have in our life.
I think this is a point to be mentioned here, that ishq, that the Supreme Leader referred to in his description.
The love.
Of the, yeah, this love. And I think that's the essence of religion. That's what it's all about. It's about that love. And I think we had a taste of that while, you know, we were living those times. And it was that love that was the greatest motivator in terms of that liberation that we now experience today.
There is no doubt in our minds, after having witnessed Imam and the things that happened with him and during his time, you know, because we're talking about Imam and his times, right? This is the program. There's no doubt in our mind about the existence of God. There's no doubt in our mind about, you know, the truthfulness and the rightfulness of the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace be upon him, about the school of Ahlul Bayt, because we experienced it. This was not, it wasn't theoretical. It wasn't something that we were taught and to memorize only.
Yeah.
It was something that we experienced on a daily basis in our lives, and the things that happened and the challenges that we were able to overcome.
It was from the heart.
And, you know, It was practical. It was real. It was not, you know, something distant that, you know, you had to, you know, go through many different twists and turns and able to understand it. It was something we experienced on a daily basis. We felt it. We saw it. We knew it. Mm-hmm. And this is the difference between Islamic spirituality and maybe others, which is that, and this is an important point.
Please.
You know, about, and I hope, you know, just to bear with me and the listeners that, you know, this might seem like a deeper academic point, but this is actually very important, which is in Islamic philosophy, in Islamic spirituality, Irfan, as the only school that has reached this level in terms of explaining it, we claim, or the school of Ahlul Bayt claims in its Irfan, that there at some point there is a unity between the person who knows and the knowledge that he has. This is different than in other schools of philosophy and in other schools of spirituality.
I see.
You know, you have that spiritual aspect in other religions, but it is not explained well. It is not understood well in as a academic matter.
I see.
Spirituality is equated with emotionalism.
That's right.
Which is not true. You know, this is not the reality of it. When we talk about reaching the highest levels of spirituality, it is an actually where there is very little emotion. It's pure logic. It's pure having a 100% knowledge and understanding of something.
A kind of certitude.
It's a certitude, exactly. A very firm certitude where you, as the knower and the knowledge, are combined. This is when we talk about the knowledge of the prophets or the imams. This is the kind of knowledge that we're talking about.
Sure.
Okay, this is what makes them different from normal humans.
In Arabic, we call it yaqeen, isn't it?
It's yaqeen, and you know, in philosophy, they call it ilm huduri, which is presence knowledge.
Yes, I've heard of this.
It's presence knowledge.
Presence knowledge.
As opposed to knowledge, which is the normal kind of knowledge that we have, which is you, as the knower, are separate from the knowledge.
Mm.
You have the knowledge, but it's separate. There's not a unity.
There's not a unity.
There's not.
But this is like a living knowledge. You're actually living it.
So what we felt and what we saw and what we experienced, as an example, I'm saying.
Yes.
So when we say we, I mean those of us who lived that time.
That's right. Absolutely.
Those of us who saw it, those of us who experienced it. You know, these are things that there is such a level of certainty for us in this. It's beyond the things that we normally talk about and the normal levels of existence that you know we experience. Again. Something acknowledged by, you know, non-Muslims, even enemies of Islam, even enemies of Imam.
Sure.
These are things that have to do with, you know, when you see it, there's no denying it.
Mm.
You know, there's many examples of, you know, Western statesmen, politicians, journalists, elites.
Yeah. Who have some kind of charisma.
Right. Who then saw what happened with Imam and acknowledged that this was different.
This was different, yes.
Than what they had experienced previously.
Previously, yes.
Okay? This has to do with what you mentioned, which is, you know, the idol smasher.
That's right.
Butchikan, you know? Mm. We always used to, there was this, I remember now that, you know, they used to have the chant when he would come in, which is, you know, you are our soul, you are, you know, the idol smasher. And, you know, as you correctly point out, you know, those idols were the idols that related to things like, you know, having to become Western or having to become Eastern, even for those who were Marxist or Communist or who wanted to join the Soviets, you know, sphere.
Yeah.
That's on one level. Yes. And, of course, on a deeper level, it has to do with your own inside and your own spiritual, you know, the Jihad Akbar, you know, the greater jihad.
The greater jihad, yes.
Which, of course, is also, you know, one of his famous speeches that he held. And it's a book. It's been translated into English. It's very good. He's actually talking to the seminary students. He's talking about that, you know, you know, the main thing in life is to have that inner greater jihad of yourself, fighting against
the
yourself.
The nafs, the jihad nafs, yes.
The animal levels of your own existence.
Sure, sure.
It's also the first hadith that he quotes in his 40 hadith, in his famous...
That's right, yes.
Starts off with 40 hadith, with the hadith where, you know, some of the companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, they returned from war, from battle, jihad askar, smaller jihad.
Smaller jihad.
And he says, you know, good for you that you went, and good that you fought in the jihad askar, but now it's time to do jihad akbar. And they go, what is jihad akbar? Mm. And he says, I'm sorry, quoting, you know, you're the hadith.
No, expert. That's all right. No, please, no. This is your platform.
He says, jihad akbar is jihad nafs. Is fighting your inner
self.
Yes. So
your inner ego,
So, you know, this is the thing about Imam. I want to quote here because I mentioned that even his enemies or those who have nothing to do with Islam.
Yes, you were going to.
Our good friend and, you know, Henry Kissinger.
Yes, we always go back to
him. We always mention him. Yeah. And I'm paraphrasing again because it's a longer quote. I don't want to take up too much time. He talks about the fact that. And he calls him Ayatollah Khomeini.
Does he?
Very good. At least he knew that, you know.
Of course. Yes. I think he was one of the more smarter men.
Right.
Of course he is.
He says that Ayatollah Khomeini, in a serious way, created a crisis for the planners of the West. Because his decisions were so thunderous, were so shaking.
Earth-shaking.
Earth-shaking.
Yeah.
So based on, based on things that they had no clue about, that he says, Henry Kissinger says, that we didn't know what to do.
Exactly.
We didn't know what to do.
Well, this is a very... Because could I just come here briefly, just for a couple of seconds? Because there was a... this was from George Shultz, I remember. He was Secretary of State at the time in the Reagan administration. And they said this. This is a quote direct from him, where he said, we had weekly meetings or almost daily meetings about the situation in Iran.
Right.
And he says everybody was called in, all the big
experts
and, you know, military people and,
strategic people.
Strategic people who knew something about Iran, really knew something about Iran. They all sat them together. Reagan then asks the question, you know, what about Ayatollah Khomeini? And he says the room was silent.
That's so funny.
He says nobody come up with anything. And, what you're quoting there is true, because, there were meetings in the White House where they just simply did not know what to do. And then eventually Reagan came up with the idea that why don't we send a cake and a couple of pistols to Rafsanjani, the president of Rafsanjani at the time, And this is the thing. And he sent a Bible. That's right. He sent a signed Bible because he did have some kind of religious background, Ronald Reagan. But he sent, with his autograph, a Bible, a signed Bible. So, this shows you that, the only thing that was left to them was to respond in religion. They couldn't do anything from the political point of view.
So he talks about how these, earth-shaking decisions
absolutely.
By the Imam left them,
completely
in disarray, not knowing what to do. He says nobody knew what to do with these decisions that were made.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically this is, again, Henry Kissinger. This was because that Ayatollah Khomeini, as he says, was conducting his affairs, his confrontation with the West, based on divine precepts. Okay?
Divine precepts.
Right? He says, and teachings.
Teachings.
This was the thing that we didn't know what to do about, because they had never confronted anybody like that. Okay? And so he said that not only was he confronting us based on these divine teachings and precepts, but he was completely sincere in his in his enmity.
And that was the real problem.
He was very sincere in his enmity. We couldn't buy him off. We couldn't scare him. We couldn't do any of that stuff.
Yeah,
this is Henry Kissinger, and I just want to mention two events which
Please.
Really prove this.
Please.
Because, again, we're going back and talking about, you know, the Supreme Leader mentioned how at night he would, you know, seek the help and guidance and grace from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And in the day he would enter the arena like a roaring lion.
Fantastic.
You know? Now, let's talk about some of these examples
Please.
Of roaring lion.
Roaring lion.
You know, and also related to what, you know, Henry Kissinger was talking about here, which is that you had at the beginning of the revolution, basically it was time to, the Shah had left, and there was the Bakhtiar government, which was you know, appointed by the Shah.
By the Shah, that's right.
But the Shah had left, and this was going to be, you know, the new way of ruling Iran, which is, you know, the Shah is, you know, only nominal. And
according to standard CIA procedure.
Right, exactly.
Right.
We have this kind of nationalist type leader who had his, you know, history of confronting the Shah, but still a constitutional monarchy, and Iran staying within the Western sphere. But instead of having the Shah and his prime ministers, having this kind of nationalist leader.
Right.
And so Imam at that time is in Paris, and they say to him, well, you know, you got what you wanted. The Shah has left. You know, isn't this what you wanted? Why deal with politics? Go back and, you know, just be the spiritual person that you are, and you're praying.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can go to Qom. You can go sit there in Qom and,
That's
you know, make your pronouncements
and
your proclamations.
You
are even allowed to mention things, you know, in the newspapers and on TV if you feel something's going wrong somewhere.
Yeah.
But let this, you know, westernized...
Yeah,
you know, these guys that are, you know, nationalists, let them rule, and, you know, just be happy with what you've reached.
And what was the response?
So, not only that, this was more than that.
That was one aspect, right.
So this was the general thing that they told him.
Okay.
Which, of course, he said, we don't even accept this new government.
Yes, that's right.
This is an appointed government by a king who didn't have any legal basis himself.
So this
government has no legal basis. We're going to have our own government.
Right.
Okay. So this is the situation. We're talking about somebody, the courage, you know, roaring lion.
Yes, roaring lion.
Roaring lion.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. So this is one of the things we loved about him.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's a man. He's gotten rid of the Shah, who's left, officially has left the country.
Yeah.
He's in Paris. Everybody's, you know, saying, look, you know, you got what you wanted. You know, okay.
Shot off.
You know, it's finished.
It's finished.
And just let these guys do it. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, a country needs these elites to run them. We can't have, you know, mullahs running things. You guys don't know what to do. You know, these guys are all Sorbonne and, you know, Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard educated.
Sure.
You know, let them just do what they have to do.
Sure.
And they're not monarchists, you know, in that sense. You know, they don't. Imam said, no way. We're not having any of that. Then this is quoted, what I'm saying now, by one of the leaders of the religious national religious parties that at that time was working with Imam, which then later left the revolution.
right.
And he's quoting this. I'm not going to mention his name because, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yes,
he was a high up member of the national religious movement in Iran at that time.
Sure.
What I'm saying, he quoted in the BBC. So this is not something that we've made up somewhere. We heard this is him saying this in the BBC.
Sure.
I heard it from him quoting it in a documentary in the BBC. He says that through me, because this person had lived in the States before and, you know, spoke English and, you know, had spent his exile time in the U.S., so the Americans felt that he's a person that they can talk to. And he had a connection with Imam, this man. He's saying that the Americans told me to tell Imam that Imam should accept the Bakhtiar government, as the way that I explained it now. You can go live in Rome and do your thing. But accept this government, and if you don't, we will tell the military to make a coup d'etat and arrest all of you. You know, the usual American, you know, like what they did in Indonesia and Chile and whatever. And if you don't accept it, and if you cause trouble, we will tell the military to make a coup d'etat. And we have the list of all the people that need to be arrested, you know, the 500, 1,000 that need to be, and we will execute all of you.
Okay.
So this is a threat.
Thruffer. Yes, the Thruffer game.
Yes,
you're back to that again.
Threat and offer. You know?
Threat and offer, yes.
So what does Imam say?
Yes.
Imam says to this man, says, tell the Americans, if you do this, I will declare jihad. I will issue a fatwa of jihad. And we will take over the whole country and we will destroy the army.
Excellent.
Okay. Roaring Lion.
Roaring Lion.
Right?
I mean, he was extremely
So this person
There's
that's
no
explaining
that.
This on BBC, you can just tell he's, like, frustrated. Like, why would Oman do such a thing? Like, he's like, why would you do
Well,
that?
He believes in the Quran, my friend.
Right.
And he believes in God.
So this is the first example of Roaring Lion and the things that Henry Kissinger is talking about, the fact that...
Yeah, I mean, this is what...
If the Americans in history had this, what they did, this proffer, this threat offer...
Proffer, yeah.
Had, you know, if you look back at history 50
yeah,
years,
of course,
it always worked.
Well, always worked.
And if it didn't, you know, they would have... Okay, so the Americans are like, okay, fine, so you're going to go challenge us, we'll see what happens. Because remember that after the revolution, we had many coup attempts.
Of course.
By the army, supported by the Americans.
Yes,
so,
of course, and
so,
you know, there were many martyrs as well,
so,
of course.
So the threat didn't work. Imam came to Iran. He made that famous speech where he said, I'm going to sock the, you know, I'm going to punch this government into the mouth. When he talked about the Bakhtiar government.
That's right, yes.
And we will establish our own government.
With the help of the people. That's right.
So, Roaring Lion.
Roaring Lion. Right?
America threatens him. The military in Iran is threatening him. He stands up. He goes to the... He gets off the plane. He goes to the grave of the martyrs in Beisht Zahra, which is where all the martyrs
are. That's right, yes, yes.
And
that's
in front of the martyrs and the graves of the martyrs, that's he says to everybody, we will punch this government into the mouth. And we will establish our own government.
I think that's a good point.
Part two of the story and the next.
Yeah, it's a good point to stop. Because punching in the mouth is the right way to go with the kind of tyranny we face at the moment in this century as well. Because there's a lot to learn from Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. Thanks very much for listening today. It leaves me only to say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dr. Mahdi Jarabi, thanks very much for your contribution once again. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Five Siberian tiger cubs born in a South Korean zoo have made their first public debut. The cubs were born at Everland Theme Park in Yongin in late June. Their birth brought joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts as they are listed as endangered species. Zookeepers say it's unusual for Siberian tigers to give birth to five babies at once. South Korean people selected the cubs' names through an online vote. Many exotic fruit plants need the tropical climate to grow, but Assyrian is producing nearly 100 types of tropical fruits at his backyard in a coastal city of Tartus. Muhammad Hassan's passion for agriculture is to the extent that he left his job in media to build a farm. He managed to create a tropical environment at his compound, and that was the reason behind his success in growing fruits that are rare in many parts of the world. In fact, he has turned his farm into what he likes to be described as a tropical cave.
I came across the world of tropical fruits as some of them existed here. Many immigrants also helped me on this path. They bought me special varieties from India, South America, the Caribbean and other countries, even China. Currently, we grow 93 types of fruits.
Hassan's success has encouraged other Tartus residents to create their own farms. The government is also assisting Hassan with his unique business. His farm is now open to tourists and visitors where they can taste the products. Hassan says he has bigger plans for the future and is thinking about using his tropical environment to raise and breed rainforest animals. In Brazil, paleontologists have discovered the fossilized remains of a dinosaur that lived roughly 70 million years ago.
It's a bipedal dinosaur with short arms, around 5 meters long, and it was at the top of the food chain in the period in which it lived. It was the predator at the time.
Paleontologists say the fossil suggests a dinosaur species known as Kurupi itata was a meat eater. They found the ancient predator's remains at one of Brazil's richest sites for dinosaur findings in the city of Sao Paulo. The first piece of Kurupi itata's fossil was unearthed during an excavation work in 2002. Until the completion of the research, a model of this species would be on display at Monte Alto's Museum of Paleontology. Experts believe the discovery would help scientists better understand paleontology on Brazilian lands. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. A Kosovar artist tries to make us understand a form of political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkent Apajogo has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Pajago was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Pajago holds 2 Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland.
Wally the Walrus has risen to fame with his extensive travels around Europe. Now the giant mammal has added Iceland to his list of trips. Wally has previously visited France, Spain and the UK. His last known location before Iceland was Ireland. Scientists were not sure at first if they had indeed seen Wally, but Seal Rescue Ireland recognized him from scars on his front flippers. The wandering walrus is 4 years old and weighs about a ton. He has covered a distance of around 5,000 kilometers in his recent trips. Wally is now on his way towards his home in the Arctic. A French zoo has had a very productive year, welcoming multiple new animals into its collection. 2 pumas, 2 jaguars, 9 Peruvian squirrel monkeys, and even rarer macaque twins are new additions to Le Mignet Zoo this summer. The animals were bred as part of a program designed to maintain and promote the conservation of endangered species. Once they reach the breeding age, these animals will be transported to other zoos to help boost the population of their species.
Now, a museum in Russia's Kaliningrad has unveiled a special exhibition to the public. It would not be exactly wrong to call the artworks out of trash. All the works exhibited are made of
rubbish. The exhibition is showcasing a wide array of objects, including sculptures, musical instruments, robots and costumes. The project was designed with the aim of raising awareness about recycling. People visiting the exhibition were delighted by the creative use of garbage. Only 7% of waste is recycled in Russia each year, while a vast amount of trash is stored in landfills.
An Egyptian artist is making incredibly tiny statues of famous historical figures and landmarks on pencil tips. 30-year-old Ibrahim Balala is based in the city of Rashid, south of Cairo. He has mastered the art of crafting miniature sculptures. Ibrahim mostly creates statues of Egyptian pharaohs, but Islamic, Greek, and Roman figures also feature in his portfolio. The artist received some criticism when he first ventured on his art, but he persevered and rose to prominence with his minuscule statues. Ibrahim's dream is to open a museum of miniature sculptures someday.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Fourteen lucky penguins have been returned to the seas off the Atlantic coast of Argentina after rehabilitating them from malnutrition and hypothermia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the chilly waters once they were released. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists in February. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile.
Another groundbreaking archaeological discovery in Peru is now catching attention. 800-year-old human remains south of the capital, Lima, highlight the ancient burial rituals in the South American country. The remains of 8 adults and children buried in a common tomb were found by a group of workers laying gas pipes at the site. They were buried with food, dishes, and musical instruments, including flutes. Archaeologists say that the 8 people lived in the ancient town of Chilca, some 60 kilometers from Lima. They say some of the bodies were buried with the shells on their heads and had bags with cocoa leaves inside them. They say the discovery will shed more light on the pre-Hispanic history of the region. Another 30 human remains had been discovered in Chilca in 2018.
A taxi company in Thailand has turned its vehicles into mini vegetable gardens to help its drivers who are out of work due to the coronavirus pandemic.
The point of this project is so that employees have something to do to reduce stress. To a certain extent, it has helped with reducing our stress, but it isn't really the answer to the situation right now. Even though the drivers and the staff are able to harvest the vegetables for food, it's just part of solving the problem. I think the government should also step in to help us too.
The taxi company is growing vegetables on the roofs and hoods of 300 disused taxis that are parked idly. Prolonged COVID-19 lockdowns have affected the drivers' income negatively so that they are unable to pay the lease of their vehicles. Therefore, working in these gardens has reduced their stress and provided the drivers and their families with food. Farmers working on the border between Venezuela and Colombia have discovered a tusk that is believed to belong to an American mastodon from 16,000 years ago.
We went to the place and the fossil was there, and then we realized it was something very important. We rescued it because there was a risk of it being lost, and at this moment, it's in the Archaeological and Paleontological Museum of Agualinda.
The experts say the discovery would help them with complementing information about extinct animals and ancient settlements. They say the finding of the tusk in the site would increase its potential contribution to scientific researchers. The discovery of mega faunal fossils in South America has been common over the past decades. In 2019, more than 800 mammoth bones were discovered near Mexico. A group of Cambodian students has designed a manned drone in an attempt to beat traffic. The drone has 8 propellers and a school chair for the pilot's seat. It can carry a human weighing up to 60 kilograms. The creative students say the drone is still in its early stages of development and testing. Equipped with 4 batteries, the human carrier drone can fly up to 4 meters and around 10 minutes above the ground.
Here we have big problems related to traffic jams, so we did some research about this before building the drone. We came up with this drone project as we had the idea that we wanted to solve some problems for our society by making a drone taxi, as well as investing drones for firefighters to help put out fires.
The prototype can or has cost around $20,000 to build. The designers say they need 2 more years to complete the project. The school has expressed hope that the drone could be used in everyday life.
Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted an art show themed with Aspiration for Peace. Organized by the Economic Cooperation Organization, the event seeks to shed light on the beauty of a global peace through the language of art. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Each one of these delicate works of art are created by an artist from a different country, each trying a unique way to highlight the need for lasting peace in the world. Dubbed Aspiration for Peace, the art gallery is organized by Eco Cultural Institute with the aim of promoting global peace through the language of art.
By holding this event, we want to send a message of peace to all countries. We invited diplomats from all embassies here to gather and unite and celebrate a peaceful gathering. Also, the artworks showcased here are created by artists from various countries, and this represents how beautiful it is for nations to live peacefully.
Art helps connect different civilizations and nations. It helps us bridge the cultural gaps and find commonalities. This will establish mutual understanding and harmony among nations, and therefore conflicts can be avoided.
In some of the artworks, images immediately communicate with the audience, even if faces are veiled. These pictures try to narrate the story of Afghan women and an uncertain future that they're facing amid the Taliban's takeover of power in Afghanistan.
The events that are taking place in my country, Afghanistan, are so painful. It might take hours to tell you how hard it is for an Afghan girl to live in insecurity and uncertainty. But through the language of art, you can understand all these words without the need for translation.
The art show was held on the occasion of the International Day of Peace. Observed every year on September 21st, the occasion was introduced by the UN General Assembly as a chance to strengthen the ideals of peace through observing 24 hours of nonviolence and ceasefire.
A picture is worth 1,000 words, and indeed, no words can be as strong as the strokes of an artist in speaking the beauty of peace. And this is how the universal language of art transcends the political and cultural boundaries and touches the hearts of viewers, no matter what language they speak. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to touch and talk about some, let's say, questions or misunderstandings which are being asked by different questioners about the theological issues and any questions regarding the religious concepts. For this, we invite Islamic researchers and scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. That's why we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to join us in this studio and help us with answer. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. Dear brothers and sisters, in our previous session, we have been talking about the uprising of Mukhtar al-Thaqafi right after the event of Karbala and his intention of taking revenge from those who murdered and killed Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his loyal companions. There were different narrations and different, let's say, interpretations on his uprising. As mentioned in our previous session, three main perspectives were mentioned by the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, in this regard. Some believe that his uprising was totally by the permission of Imam and on the right way that the Imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam wanted. The other says that no, he did something personal and it had nothing to do with the permission from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam or others. And the third, which is also a sort of moderate view, says that he tried to take the revenge of the tragedy of Karbala, but he had some extremist also viewpoints and which were not necessarily based on the viewpoints of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. We promise to continue this discussion in our today's session. Now we want to again ask the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, to shed some more light on this issue and tell us how can we collect between all these opposing ideas on him and put them aside to what was said or what was narrated by Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, namely Imam Sajjad or Imam Baqir alayhi salam, if these narrations are true. Sheikhana, we would be thankful if you tell us more in this regard and explain more about the personality of Mukhtar and his intention and if this uprising was actually approved by Ahlul Bayt or not.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, when it comes to the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt about the personality of Mukhtar and his uprising, somehow we can say that we have contradicting narrations. Some narrations admire him and some narrations somehow reprimand and reproach him. Let me share some of these narrations. There are some narrations admiring him. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is quoted as saying, "May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give good reward to Mukhtar." According to another narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam met Abu al-Hakam, son of Mukhtar, and first Imam Baqir alayhi salam honored Abu al-Hakam and honored Mukhtar as well. And then Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said, "May Allah's mercy be upon your father, that is Mukhtar." Now, Allama Mamaqani, he says that when Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is sending divine mercy on Mukhtar, it means that Imam alayhi salam was satisfied with his action. It means that Mukhtar believed in the imamate of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. He was not deviated from the true path. Otherwise, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam would not send divine blessing and mercy upon him. According to another narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that the fact that the heads of Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad and Umar ibn Sa'd were sent to Medina by Mukhtar was a cause for the happiness of the Ahlul Bayt. And he says that, according to this narration, after the tragedy of Karbala, no women among the Ahlul Bayt use any kind of makeup until Mukhtar sent the heads of Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad and Umar ibn Sa'd to the city of Medina. So it shows that it was a cause for the happiness of the Ahlul Bayt. So these narrations are about The fact that Mukhtar Thaqafi was highly respected by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, some narrations reproach him. For example, it's been mentioned that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam did not receive the gift sent by Mukhtar Thaqafi and calls him Kadhab, a big liar. Some scholars believe that it is a weak narration. Mm-hmm. Another narration reads that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says Mukhtar used to tell lies against Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. The chain of this narration is weak too. According to another narration, when Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam was in Sabat, Mukhtar gave this suggestion to his uncle Sa'd ibn Mas'ud that let's give Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam to Muawiyah so that we can keep our position. Now, Ayatollah Khoui, who is one of the scholars who admire Mukhtar a lot, he says that first of all, this narration is mursal, it doesn't have an authentic chain of the narration. And second of all, maybe Mukhtar was not serious in his suggestion. He wanted to somehow test and try his uncle. The same is has been mentioned by Sayyid Muhsin Amin. In another narration, it's been mentioned that Mukhtar will go to the hellfire, but he will be Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam will intercede for him, and he will go to paradise. According to some scholars, this is a weak narration. Now, you see, we have these narrations, which somehow they are contradicting each other, and that is why we have different viewpoints by Shia scholars, and in each group we have big names. Mm-hmm. Among those people who, support Mukhtar Thaqafi and his uprising, and they believe that it was with the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, we can mention scholars like Ibn al-Mahili. He says that the words of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, which talk about him in a positive manner, and they have prayed for him, it's a sign that he was a righteous person with good intention. As I mentioned, the late Mamakani, he says that he believed in the imamate of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, and he says that in one case, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam sends rahmah upon him three times, and it's enough for us to come to this conclusion that he was a righteous person.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Allama Hilli also discusses about that. So my point is that during the history, different Shia scholars, they have talked about this issue. Mm-hmm. The Allama Hilli, finally, he prefers the narrations which admire him over the narrations which, reprimand him. Among the contemporary scholars, some of them, they have talked about this issue. I can refer to Ayatollah Khoui and Allama Amini. They also prefer the narrations of madh or admiration. Praising. Yeah. And Ayatollah Khoui, for example, he says that the uprising of Mukhtar was with the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Again, Allama Amini, he believes that three Imams, that is Imam Sajjad, Imam Baqir, and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, they have sent blessings upon Mukhtar, and it's a good sign that he was a righteous person. Mm-hmm. Then we have a group of scholars that somehow they have stopped giving their viewpoints about this issue.
Yeah.
So again, it is another sign that it's a pretty complicated issue. So much so that some of the great scholars, they have stopped giving a final conclusion about him. For example, Mirza Muhammad Astarabadi, he says that we are not allowed to talk bad against Mukhtar, but the narrations talking about his virtues cannot be trusted. So finally he says that I'm not able to decide about this issue. And also we can mention a great scholar like Allama Majlisi. He says that the faith of Mukhtar was not complete and his uprising was without the permission of Imam, but because of the fact that he did a lot of good actions, maybe he will reach salvation. So finally he says that I also prefer not to give a final conclusion about
it. Is there any reference to the basis that he reached to this conclusion?
Yes, in Bihar al-Anwar he has talked in details about this. He has evaluated different narrations. You know, the point is that, let me give a reason for some of these scholars. And today in our contemporary time, we see that, of course, most of the scholars, they believe that Mukhtar was a very righteous person, and he wasn't, looking for power. Somehow he had the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. But again, we have few Shia scholars who do not agree with that. We have different points. One point is that when it is time for taqiyya, which is roughly translated as dissimulation, it is very difficult to come to a kind of conclusion. Mm-hmm. For example, we have a personality like Zurara. Mm-hmm. We know how great he is and what a great role he played in spreading the Islamic teachings.
That's true.
But for such a person, we have some narrations against him.
Yeah.
So what is the what is the point? The point is that
he was at the time of taqiyya.
Yeah. The imams were living in a time that they thought that maybe Zurara might be killed by the caliphs of the time. So they said some narrations against him so that those people come to this understanding that Zurara is not a true companion of the Imam. That is why Imam for example is saying some bad words against him. Maybe the same is true about Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is living under the very difficult situation. And he is not able, some scholars argue, he is not able to directly mention that I'm supporting Mukhtar. Otherwise, his life would be in danger. Mm-hmm. That is why, according to some narration, he mentions to some of his companions that Muhammad bin Hanafiya is my representative in this uprising, so that the Umayyad Caliphate may not consider Imam as the leader of this uprising. Rather, they consider Muhammad bin Hanafiya as the leader. So this may have brought about some complication. And
maybe he wanted to bring a sort of immunity for Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
That's the point. So those scholars who, agree with the uprising of Mukhtar, they say that the uprising of Mukhtar was with the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, but because Imam Sajjad alayhi salam wanted to practice taqiyya, he was not, religiously speaking, allowed to publicly and directly support Mukhtar, and that is why he appointed Muhammad bin Hanafiya. But the other group of scholars, they refer to some narrations which are against Mukhtar. The scholars who are pro-Mukhtar, they say that maybe they are weak or they were mentioned in the street of Taqiyya. Mm-hmm. Imam mentions that I'm against Mukhtar so that his life would not be endangered by the rulers of the time. Mm-hmm. Some scholars believe that no, Imam mentioned that not in the street of Taqiyya. And we have the same problem in some other issues. So that is one of the reasons that I believe that we have these contradicting narrations. Imam is in the state of taqiyya. He's not able to directly lead the uprising. Maybe he says some narrations against Mukhtar.
Yeah.
And it causes some people to, come to a kind of confusion about him. And the same is true about belief in the imamate of Muhammad bin Hanafiya. Those scholars who are pro-Mukhtar, they believe that this is not the case. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam himself chose Muhammad bin Hanafiya as his representative. But those who are against Mukhtar, they say that no, he did not refer to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Rather, he referred to Muhammad bin Hanafiya.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. Yeah, very true. So we need to to imagine ourselves in the time that these issues actually had happened. To imagine the political situation the status of Imam Sajjad and Muhammad ibn Hanafiya at those times, to see if they were allowed or they had this freedom to say freely about Mukhtar or not. So we need to consider the conditions that the Imam and the Mukhtar himself actually were in. So for such studies as you